in the middle of the night, I had a phone call, and he said, I thought you ought to know that Rocky was arrested and is in jail. And great sadness and stress entered our whole family.
And that all steamed from a little matchbox of pot. And somehow Rocky ended up with the blame. And it probably had to do with how bad they wanted Rocky Erickson.
Then he went to trial, and an attorney in Austin got him off on insanity, figuring that it would be safer for Rocky to be in a hospital than it would be jail. That was the whole point of it. And then I came to visit him one day, and he jumped the fence, and we just took off.
The authorities frowned on the fact that Rocky would disappear for a week or so. They'd always rearrest him. They'd know where he'd go. They'd go to Dana's house, arrest him again, take him back to this hospital. She'd go in there and get him again, not realizing that they could send him to a maximum security mental hospital, and they did.
You know, in the old days, they'd take him out and hang him or whatever have you. But in modern day times, there was a better way to do it. Send him to Rusk, say he's crazy. You see, after they had the riots up there, people were afraid to work there. The riots, I understand, were pretty bad.
It was a bloody, bloody mess. A war doctor, and they captured him, and they were gonna give him EST treatments, electroshock treatments, like he had given some of the patients. They said, we're gonna shock him till he shits.
Pretty tough on him, really and truly. Most of the time, Rocky would have a yellow legal pad, and he'd be sitting in the hallway somewhere writing music, real weak and slumped down like that. He's a real nice little guy. He didn't have a whole lot to say. He wanted to write his music. He wanted to play his music. And that's all. At least it took his mind off where he was, you know.
When I first interviewed Rocky, I had to draw everything out of him and to find out what his interest was, and I told him we were forming a band.
The bass player, he had killed two small children, raped the mother, and stabbed her with a penknife thing, put one of her eyes out. Another one was involved in a rape of a young boy down in Houston years and years ago. And they murdered him too, by the way, after they raped him. Another one had killed his parents and one of his siblings. He played guitar. The little guy that was involved in the gang rape of the boy played tambourine. Rocky was there for some kind of minor charge. Now, you tell me if that makes sense, because it doesn't.
Seems like a bell rings, time for deja vu. Everything is familiar, being here with you. All you've ever had before, you've had to understand. Now all you have to do is want to have at your command. I have always been here before, allowing my mind's call. Incorporate more, never stops this flow. I have always been here before.
Rocky Erickson co-founded the 13th Floor Elevators in late 1965, and in 1966, when Rocky Erickson was 19 years old, the 13th Floor Elevators released their debut album, The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, which featured Rocky's signature song, You're Gonna Miss Me. The band released another legendary album, their second album in 1967, called Easter Everywhere. A third album, Bull of the Woods, was released in 1969, but Rocky Erickson didn't play a major role in that album's creation because in 1968, while performing at the World's Fair in San Antonio, Texas, He started speaking gibberish and was eventually diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic and sent to a Houston psychiatric hospital where he involuntarily received electric shock treatment. Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators were vocal proponents of LSD and marijuana, and they were therefore the target of harassment by law enforcement. In 1969, Rocky Erickson was arrested for possession of a single marijuana joint in Austin, Texas. Facing a possible 10-year prison sentence, his lawyer recommended he plead not guilty by reason of insanity as a means of avoiding prison. He was first sent to the Austin State Hospital, but after several escapes, he was sent to the maximum security Rusk State Hospital in Rusk, Texas, where he was surrounded by maniacs, as you heard at the beginning of the episode, and he was subjected to more shock treatments. Rocky Erickson was at Rusk State Hospital until 1972, and he was never really the same after his release. Whatever mental illness he went in suffering from was not only not treated properly, but made worse. Let's hear a song that Rocky Erickson recorded at his home after being released from Rusk State Hospital. In 1974, Rocky Erickson formed a band called Bleeb Alien, which eventually became known as Rocky Erickson and the Aliens. Erickson's lyrics from here on out would be very interesting, to say the least. Lots of strange imagery. Paranoia, paranormal, Scary Monsters, etc. In 1979, Erickson recorded 15 songs with Stu Cook from Creedence Clearwater Revival producing, and those songs would be released on two overlapping albums in 1980 and 1981, Rocky Erickson and the Aliens, a self-titled record but released by CBS in the UK, and The Evil One, which was released in 1981 by a San Francisco indie label called 415. Let's hear a song from that self-titled record released by CBS. It's called White Faces. Rocky Erickson later teamed up with an Austin band called The Explosives as his backing band, and they played a lot of shows in Austin in the early 80s, but Rocky Erickson's mental health continued to decline. He began insisting that his body was being inhabited by a Martian and that humans were attacking him because of this. He later moved on to an obsession with junk mail, which resulted in an arrest for mail theft in 1989. Let's hear another great song by Rocky Erickson, which I think was first released in 1986 on a collection of songs called Don't Slander Me. I'm not sure when this was actually recorded, but I love this song. It's called Nothing in Return. Rocky Erickson has made a couple of comebacks since in the 90s and more recently, and he seems to have come through it all right and found happiness in his later years. I used to live in Austin, and I once saw him at the grocery store. I didn't approach him. He looked a little bit uncomfortable with his surroundings, which I guess he will probably never entirely get over.
And Lawrence from Euphoria, I'll share your tent, pay your rent. It's worth every single cent. And Lawrence from Euphoria, you rise from the deep, come in your sleep, no more will you weep. I'm Lawrence from Euphoria. There's Vivian from Oblivion, she does it for a fee for my friends and me. She's Vivian M. Lawrence, Lawrence from Euphoria. There's Ellie Mae from California, she does it all right, but her lips are tight. She tucks me into bed at night. She's Vivian, twin sister Ellie Mae. And I'm Lawrence from Euphoria.
That was a song called Lawrence of Euphoria by Alexander Skip Spence from his infamous 1969 solo album, Or. Skip Spence was briefly a member of Jefferson Airplane before forming his own band, Moby Grape. I'm just going to read to you now from Wikipedia. During the recording session for Moby Grape's second album, Wow, in 1968, Spence attempted to break down a bandmate's hotel room door with a fire axe while under the influence of LSD. Spence's deterioration in New York and the fire axe incident are described by bandmate Jerry Miller as follows. Skippy changed radically when we were in New York. There were some people there that were into harder drugs and a harder lifestyle and some very weird shit. And so he kind of flew off with those people. Skippy kind of disappeared for a little while. Next time we saw him, he had cut off his beard and was wearing a black leather jacket with his chest hanging out, with some chains and just sweating like a son of a gun. I don't know what the hell he got a hold of, man, but it just whacked him. And the next thing I know, he axed my door down in the Albert Hotel. They said at the reception area that this crazy guy had held an axe to the doorman's head. As described by bandmate Peter Lewis, it appears that both Jerry Miller and bandmate Don Stevenson were targets of Spence. We had to do the album in New York because the producer, David Rubinson, wanted to be with his family, so we had to leave our families and spend months at a time in hotel rooms in New York City. Finally, I just quit and went back to California. I got a phone call after a couple of days. They'd played a Fillmore East gig without me, and Skippy took off with some black witch afterward who fed him full of acid. It was like that scene in the Doors movie. He thought he was the Antichrist. He tried to chop down a hotel room door with a fire axe to kill Don Stevenson to save him from himself. He went up to the 52nd floor of the CBS building where they had to wrestle him to the ground, and Rubinson pressed charges against him. They took him to the Tombs and then the Bellevue, and that's where he wrote Or. When he got out of there, he cut that album in Nashville, and that was the end of his career. They shot him full of Thorazine for 6 months. They just take you out of the game. During his 6 months in Bellevue, Spence was diagnosed with schizophrenia. On the day of his release, he drove a motorcycle directly to Nashville to record his only solo album, with no other musicians appearing on it. Mental illness, drug addiction, and alcoholism prevented Skip Spence from sustaining a career in the music industry. Much of his life was spent in third-party care as a ward of the state of California, and either homeless or in transient accommodations in his later years. He remained in and around San Jose and Santa Cruz. Spence died of lung cancer in 1999, 2 days before his 53rd birthday.
Honey, is there something wrong?
Just sort of, you know, thinking about tomorrow. The lawyer said that I'll probably get off, you know, probation or something like that, but he might be just saying that, you know, if I don't jump bail, take off.
Well, what are you gonna do?
I was thinking of cutting out to Florida tonight.
Tonight?
Yeah, I think I could get lost down there. And it's real warm down there. I could head right down to the beaches, maybe even sleep out on the beaches at night. And...
But they'll find you. They'll find you wherever you go.
Yeah, but I'm used to being independent. I couldn't be put in a cage or anything. And besides, you'll never wait.
Yes, I will.
You say that now, but you don't really mean that.
I will wait. I promise I will.
Promise. Come here, baby.
I love you.
Armin Schaubrick had the misfortune to be sent to New York's maximum security Elmira prison at the age of 17, sentenced to 18 months for burglary and grand larceny. Later in life, he would tell the story of his imprisonment with a 3-record set released in 1978 called A Lot of People Would Like to See Armin Schaubrick Dead, the cover of which depicts Schaubrick smiling, a bloody bullet hole in his forehead. Over the course of the 3 LPs, in 22 scenes, which combine music and dialogue, Schaubrick tells the story of his teenage incarceration in somewhat graphic detail. To quote Ira Robbins in Trouser Press, "This catharsis may have been necessary for him, but it's more an accomplishment than an entertainment."
Thank you. that Jesus was born. Don't let him hang there. You gotta cut that man down. 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 Ooh. 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 I saw him hanging there, swinging by his belt, swinging by his belt. Come Christmas morning, you gotta cut my friend down. You gotta cut my friend down. You gotta cut my friend down. Cut my friend down. You gotta cut my friend down. You gotta cut my friend down. Cut my friend down. You gotta cut my friend down. You gotta cut that man down.
Can we have 24145 step in now? 24145.
It's getting to be a long day.
Yes. Just sit down over there.
Maybe break for lunch after this
one. Yes, right there. Your name is Armin P. Shawbrook?
Yeah.
Armin, we are here representing the Parole Board of New York State. Do you feel that you have learned anything since you came here?
Yeah, I learned a whole lot here, you know.
Have him speak up. I can't hear him at all.
Speak up, Armin.
Yeah, I learned quite a bit here.
Armin, will you have a job waiting on upon your release?
Yeah, I wrote to the local grocery store, you know. I said, hire me and an ex-con, but a real good worker. And, you know, I was thinking it over and might have a job.
You might have a job?
I got a job.
I see. Armin, have you been attending church regularly?
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
Mm-hmm.
Religion is the general subject of Shawbrook's second album, I Came to Visit But Decided to Stay, the cover of which shows Shawbrook dressed as a priest and lying on a grave, his guitar leaning against the headstone. Many of the record's lyrics criticize various aspects of the church. Let's hear a song from it called Father Michael Loves Sister Jennifer.
Same old door, do. Don't you do? Well, I shouldn't do do. I shouldn't be do doing by the way. I shouldn't give him my love. Sister Jennifer, I love you.
In 1978, Armin Shalbrook released a twisted album which lives up to its name. The record's called Ratfucker. Here's what Ira Robbins had to say. With Ratfucker, Shalbrook created the masterpiece he'd been building toward. Were it not for the indelicate title and similarly strong language throughout, this concept album about death and depravity might have finally found him a major audience. Shalbrook posits himself as an assortment of wretched characters, a flesh peddler, a hired killer, an abuser of women, and sneers his way to disconcerting believability against a musical backdrop of excellent up-tempo rock and funk. Cinematic and convincing, obscuring the line between art and life, Ratfucker uses horns and a background chorus to complement the characters singing, talking, and growling. In painting images of villains who wear their sickness like a badge, Shalbrook delivers a rough, stunning tour de force. Let's hear an example. This is a song from Ratfucker called The Independent Hitter.
I'm not in the fucking mafia, I'm an independent. I'm an independent fucking freelancer cat. No glory in being all alone, but guess what I fucking do, and I do it well. Do it well. You fucking see me, you're fucking dead. You're fucking dead. You may as well bury you now. Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work and go. Envelope full of money sitting in my pocket. 38 lubricated man. What I do, don't belong to the mob, oh no, I'm real good, you know, you see me, then it's too fucking too late, cause you're already fucking dead. I'm an independent, freelancing hitter, real good at what I do, you see me, you're positive, you see me, then it's too fucking late, too late, you're already dead. Independent hitter, you family play your game. Try to scare each other. You buy them a little this, then you buy them a little of that. And then you come down to real life and hand me a fucking envelope full of fucking money, and then I. You see me? You're positive you see me? Well, it's too late because no, too late for a wheel. Too late for extra motion. Too late to ride a wheel. Too late for anything except a baby flowers. Independent, I'm good at what I do. Hi-ho, hi-ho, that's off the work I go. Hi-ho, hi-ho, that's off the fucking work I go. Guns lubricated up, plain 38. No fancy baggage gun for me, man. No silencer. When I aim a gun into a fucking Italian restaurant when you're eating dinner, and I want the noise to be heard. Onto the fucking table. Hi-ho, hi-ho, I'm professional. I don't ever fucking run from a place. I fucking walk very slow. No one follows me that way. I'm professional.
I have 400 albums. And people say, that's impossible. Are they all good? I mean, this can't be real. But I've been home recording since 1966. So do the math. It's not really any big deal. I'm always recording. Good stuff, bad stuff. I don't really try to rank the best over the worst because I love bad music, and a lot of my fans love bad music, noisy music, lo-fi, blah, blah, blah.
R. Stevie Moore has released over 400 cassette, CDR, and digital online albums since 1968. Moore is a proficient guitarist, bassist, keyboardist, percussionist, and songwriter. In 1966, he began pursuing what would become his lifelong passion, home recording as a one-man band, using reel-to-reel tape decks set up in his parents' basement. He briefly attended Vanderbilt University, but dropped out in 1971 to pursue his passions for writing, recording, and performing music. Moore later had built up enough material to issue his home-recorded 1976 debut album, Phonography, on his Uncle Harry H.P. Palmer's H.P. Music label. The initial run was limited to only 100 pressings. Trouser Press magazine gave the album positive reviews, calling it an outrageous collection of musical brain spewage and a true slash of genius in its December 1977 issue. Let's hear a song from Phonography called You and Me. Inspired by the attention he received for Phonography, R. Stevie Moore released a second similar album in 1978, which he called Delicate Tension. Let's hear a couple of songs from that record now.
Oh, Pat. Well, I like it gas, turn up
the thermostat.
Which brings us to this next song, one that inadequately describes local canine consideration as witnessed by us all. 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Starts following her around with a tape recorder and his little Super 8, following her around and making movies and tape recording her, and begging Lori to say, "I love you, Dan," into the tape, which she eventually does.
Did you say, "I love you, Danny"? You want me to?
Mm-hmm.
I love you, Danny.
She has no idea. He's massively obsessed with her.
As soon as she spoke to me, you know, she was so nice, you know, and I was just completely, madly in love. And I didn't know it, but she already had a boyfriend. At this time, Pete Arner went to mortician school in Florida. And so he, like, left mortician school and came back. After she got married, a friend of mine's grandfather died, and the funeral was at Arner's funeral home. She was there hanging coats. And as soon as I walked in, I said, "Hi, how are you?" And I shook her hand. And I looked behind her, and there was an empty casket. And I just thought, well, I'm just going to crawl in there.
If I had my own way, you'd be with me here today. But I rarely have my own way. I guess that's why you're not here with me today. In the library instead. You can't buy no respect. I said, "Hey, lady, what can you expect when I'm lying on the floor? You're a lovely lady, but you don't want to be no girl of mine. Well, the only thing you ever done for me was help me waste my time. And I saw you at the funeral. You were standing there like a temple. I said, 'Hi, how are you?' Hello, and I pulled up a casket and crawled in. Yes, I did. Climbed up a mountain, and I looked around. Some kind of circus with all them clowns. I said, 'Hey, wait a minute, can we slow down a bit?' And I almost got hit by a truck. Well, it just goes to show ya that we're all on our own, scrounging for our own share of good. Stab your brother in the back and pick up your paycheck. Goodbye, lonely heart drawings, they never did work anyhow. I'm looking for a nice girl and I don't want no cow. I'm heading out west, gonna find me the best. Well, I played the game, but I failed the test. If I can't be a lover, then I'll be a pest. Yes, I will.
Daniel Johnston is a diagnosed schizophrenic, but he is also a very, very gifted songwriter. Some, including me, might use the word genius. If you have not seen the documentary The Devil and Daniel Johnston, do yourself a favor and watch it ASAP. I was lucky enough to see the film at the South by Southwest Film Festival in 2006 with Daniel and his parents in attendance. And having long been a Daniel Johnston fan by that point, the film was absolutely mind-blowing because it was all true, all of the stories and the legends. Lori was real, and you get to see her in the movie, and she was beautiful, and you understood why Daniel was obsessed with her, and she really did marry an undertaker, and he really did cause a plane crash because he thought he was Captain America or Casper the Friendly Ghost or somebody, and so many of his hijinks that you heard about, the rumors and the legends, they were documented with audio and video, and it's all in the movie, and it was all true, and it's just a fascinating film. Between 1981 and 1988, Daniel Johnston released 10 cassette tapes on a label called Stress Records. They were cheap tapes in these weird clear plastic cases with the covers glued to the case. They were recorded on a boombox or a tape recorder, mostly just Daniel and a piano. Very lo-fi, but many of the songs are just incredible. I've already played a couple of the songs from these tapes on the podcast. I know I played Man Obsessed on the Tickled Ivories episode, And if you go listen to the very end of my cover songs episode, you will hear Daniel's original version and then my own cover version of his song Scuttlebutt. We heard Grievances from his first tape, Songs of Pain, earlier in the episode. Now let's hear another song from that same tape. It's called Brainwash.
Me and a friend went out one night, walking in the street. We talked of God and the end of the world. I stuck my head in a fire hydrant. The night was cool, it was around the time that the fat ladies come out. While river rats broke windows and performed a natural act. We walked halfway across the town and sang in an amphitheater. And then we walked a little further and admired some graffiti. Dodging cars as we crossed the highway, we sure must have looked ugly. My shirt was soaked, the grass was wet, I stuck my head in a fire hydrant. We talked of things in the good book while there was a naked lady on TV. She had no care, she had no shame, she had little propellers on. My friend, he said, I can't help but look at this naked lady's body. I said, dear friend, you got a dirty mind, stick your head in a fire hydrant. Earlier that evening, I went to a banquet, hoping she might be there. But she wasn't, so I went to this other girl's house who was freaked out on drugs. So later after that, after the first part of the song, on my way home, I drove past this other girl's house who will not accept my calls. I noticed she had her light on as I drove slowly by. I wonder if she noticed me. I stuck my head in a fire hydrant.
Up next is a song called Only Missing You from Daniel Johnston's 1983 tape, More Songs of Pain.
Don't know, wish I did. Wish I had someone else instead. Can't stop, wish I could. Nothing else in my empty head. Only missing you. Seems like a million years. Must have been a million tears.
This is from Daniel's 1984 tape, Retired Boxer. It's called I'll Do Anything But Break Dance For You, Darling.
Thank you.
In 1988, Daniel Johnston visited New York City and recorded an album with producer Kramer, who would release two albums by Johnston on his Shimmy Disc record label. 1990 came out in 1990 and Artistic Vice in 1991. I really love Artistic Vice. Let's hear a song from each album. Some Things Last a Long Time from 1990 and Honey, I Sure Miss You from Artistic Vice.
Something lasts a life.
I lived in Austin, Texas in 1997 to 1998 and again from about 2002 to 2007, and I was lucky enough to get to see Daniel Johnston live quite a few times, sometimes with a piano, often with an acoustic guitar. Let's hear an example of the kind of song he was playing at those gigs. Here's one called Love Will See You Through. So you've just heard a pretty good selection of Daniel Johnston material, and I hope you agree that he had or has a very special gift, and it's too bad that he never got the chance to or was able to make a real, professionally performed and produced record, because his catalog of songs honestly is astonishing. Like I said, check out the movie The Devil and Daniel Johnston. It's an amazing film. Hey.
My key. Love, I told you on my key, Dennis.
Alright, so that was an episode I'm calling Fringe Artists, Part 1. Maybe I'll do more episodes like this in the future, so let me know if you enjoyed it. rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com or go to the blog, rockandorrollpodcast.blogspot.com. Go click like on the Facebook page. You can send me a message on Facebook. You can leave a comment on the blog. You can send me an email. if you're out there listening, it'd be great to hear from you. I always like to hear from people, get a feeling for who's out there, who's listening, who enjoys the show, what you like about it, what you'd like to hear in the future, etc. And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with one more song by Daniel Johnston. A very fitting way to end the episode. It's really just a wonderfully compelling song. I appreciate it so much. It comes from Daniel's 1983 tape, Yip Jump Music. Daniel did a couple of tapes there where he was experimenting with some other instrumentation, mainly a chord organ, I think. So this song is from that period, and it's just great. It's called Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Your Grievances. Just listen.
Don't let the sun go down on your grievance. Respect love of the heart over lust of the flesh.
Be back.